podcast this week, we have Oscar-nominated heavyweights in the form of the Secret Agent star Wagner Moura and his director Kleber Mondonca Filho. Plus, the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that nearly stepped on Florence Pugh's dress. Sorry about that, Flo. Can I call you Flo? No, didn't think so. Overstepped. Sorry. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. And welcome to the Empire Podcast this week. I'm joined by three colleagues of such lethal cunning. Geek Queen Helen O'Hara is here, of course. Hello. Fifth Beatle, John Nugent, the man who looks more like George Harrison than the man they cast to play George Harrison, is here. Hello. Hello. How are you?
Hello. I'm good. How are you?
Good, good, good. And of course, James Dyer is here. Hello, Jimbo.
Hello, Chris.
How are you?
I don't know. I approach this podcast with a sense of impending doom.
Now you know how the listeners feel.
Perhaps that's my new nickname, Dr. Doom.
Dr. Doom.
Yeah.
Wow, how original.
Has that been taken? I don't think that's been taken.
Has it been taken? It has not, to my knowledge, been taken. But listeners to the podcast, regular listeners, new listeners won't know that Jimbo used to have a nickname. It was the Camino Kid because he loves Star Wars so much. And he gets it right all the time. All the Star Wars facts are at his fingertips, at his disposal.
He made one small error once. And we decided to make a nickname out of it.
One time I confused Camino with Geonosis. One time! And you're never allowed to live it down. Jesus!
So he rejected that nickname finally at the end of last year. So now we're on a crusade to find Jimbo a new nickname. And no, Jimbo doesn't count. And so far you've rejected finally all the nicknames that the good listeners of this podcast have sent in good faith. You might like this one. This is from Rangatang on Blue Sky, who says, another nickname suggestion for James. Iron Jim is a nickname James Cameron earned on set. I feel like James might accept this as a tribute to his favorite director, although we might want to downgrade the metal a bit. Aluminium Jim.
Tin Jim.
Tin Jim.
No, just
Tin Jim.
No to Tin Jim. That's not accepted.
And the flaw in my plan for this nickname is that James has to be happy with the nickname as well. So I think we could be here for some time, or until we get bored. One of the two.
Yeah,
but I like Tin Jim.
I'm sure you do. I'm sure you do.
See, Aluminium Jim. American listeners immediately are like, "What the hell is that?"
It's aluminum.
It's aluminum. Aluminium Jim. No, Tim Jim. We'll try it. We'll try it.
No, we won't.
We'll try it out.
We will never.
Just for this 1 week.
Absolutely not.
And we'll see how we go. But anyway, I nearly stepped on Florence Pugh's dress. What? How did that happen? Helen.
Oh my God. We were hobnobbing with the stars, as we so often do.
Yes.
As we so often do.
Helen and I went last night to see Cynthia Erivo play Draculier in Draculier. They've misspelled it on the poster, but indeed mispronounced it all the way through the show. Mm. It wasn't a date. Helen and I are not having an affair. It was just two people who are married meeting up without their spouses. That's all it was.
That's all it was.
That's all it was.
Sounds a lot like a date.
What? Helen, were we on a date?
Oh my God.
Do we have to log this with HR?
Thank you, Mike.
What's going on? Anyway, yes, we went to see Draculier. Where was it? The Noel Coward Theatre.
Noel Coward Theatre. Noel Coward Theatre, darling.
Drury Lane. Was it Drury Lane?
No, it wasn't. St. Martin's Lane.
St. Martin's Lane, darling. And Cynthia Erivo, this is a one-woman play, one-woman version of Draculier, in which she plays 23 roles.
Yeah, something like that.
Including Draculier, Hugh Jackman, and some of the other people. Keanu Reeves.
Winona Ryder.
Winona Ryder, yeah, absolutely. Good
Peter
Lord.
Cushing, they're all in there.
Mm-hmm. Monica Bellucci.
Jerry Butler.
The
best Draculier.
I'd love to see Cynthia Erivo play Jerry Butler. She should do a one-woman version of the Has Fallen films.
As vampire.
I'd love to see her go, let's play a game of fuck off. You go first. That'd be amazing. Oh, okay, that can't get out of my head now. That's extraordinary. But yes, we went to see Draculier. It was a press night.
It was.
So there were lots of famous people there who were very, very well dressed. Helen.
I was not, okay?
No.
Like, I thought about getting my respectable coat out of the wardrobe, but it would have meant going all the way upstairs and, like, getting the respectable coat. And I was like, it's cold. Like, so I just put on, like, my anorak and turned up at the...
She looked like Adrian Mole.
I mean, I'm not even going to deny it. I was underdressed.
She had a clipboard and everything.
Especially when we got to the theater and literally I'd kind of forgotten that press night is essentially premiere of a theater show. And so I was just, you know, thinking there'd be other scruffy looking journalists. And of course, I'd forgotten that like the A-list would be turning out. And literally as we arrived at the theater, 007 was getting out of the car and making her way into the building. Lashana Lynch was literally there in like full garb. We had also gotten the start time of the show wrong, and we'd been like merrily telling each other, it's fine, we've got time to go and grab some food before. Well, we'll just pick up the tickets and then we'll go and grab some food. Not realizing that it was a 7 o'clock and not a 7:30 start.
Oh, no.
So then we had to hot foot it to the bar to like stock
up. We had to hot foot it to the bar.
All of the food that they had to keep us going through this ordeal.
Yes, one pack of Maltesers, please. Yes, sorry, sir. You're going to have to apply for a bank loan.
Essentially.
I have a question. Point of order. So this was press night. This was like a podcast outing that was done.
Can't
help noticing that I wasn't invited.
All right. Two things. We were only given two tickets.
Right.
It's a Tuesday night.
Uh-huh.
You famously can do Tuesdays.
Except I literally walked past the cinema last night. The cinema, the theatre.
The cinema?
I don't even know where it is.
Well, see, I think that's where I went wrong.
I walked past the theatre and I was like, oh, look, there's a red carpet there. What's going on there? And I thought, I wonder if I'll see Helen, because I knew Helen was going.
What were you doing on a Tuesday night?
Well, you know, because I'm a professional, Chris. I came in to watch, checks notes, films for this podcast.
He only had two tickets.
Yeah.
To be fair to him, he didn't know you were in yesterday. I told him as we were already sitting in the theatre.
Right.
I don't have GPS tracking on you.
No, it's fine.
It's absolutely fine. I wandered down to Martin's Lane singing quietly to myself.
Sorry,
in the rain.
Tin Jim.
It wasn't Tin Jim.
Let Tin Jim have his moment. You would have hated it.
I like vampires.
I don't know that he would have.
I've seen Twilight.
Oh, you'd loved it.
Actually, you would have loved that.
Anyway.
Team Edward.
I have actually bought tickets to go next week.
You can go with Helen next week. Go with Helen next week.
Wow.
I was also available, just in case.
John, you were, if Helen had said no, if James had said no.
If Nick had said no.
I'm like Princess Eugenie on the line of succession.
Yeah, kind
of
you thing. Really are.
Yeah.
You're King
like,
Ralph.
Yeah, yes, you are King Ralph. If we were playing like a Telltale video game at the moment, Helen, there'd be a picture of me and it would just say, James will remember that above his head.
Is that a thing? Okay, I don't know James.
We do things all the time. James. We hang out all the time.
No, it's fine.
There's times we don't even tell Helen where we're going.
We have one eye open.
We have our special moments. Mm. We have our special time.
I don't
James and Chris's special time. You know that.
I don't get invited to poker nights. I mean,
Helen doesn't get invited to poker nights.
Helen, there is always an open invitation to our strip poker nights.
Helen,
absolutely fine.
You would hate it. Anyway. Florence Pugh.
So we went to the bar where I felt even more underdressed because that's obviously where all the like celebs had taken refuge from the hoi polloi in the lobby. And we stepped over, we were trying to get them back to our seats to hide the fact that we were wildly underdressed and stepped over together.
One of us was wildly underdressed.
Okay, Chris was wearing an M&S wool coat. He would like it known that he was very respectable looking.
A very nice blazer and a top I probably got from H&M.
And some jeans and trainers.
Right. So you were both dressed to the nines then?
At least to the fives.
But seriously, how often do you really look at a man's shoes? No one's looking at my feet. When I'm in that room, all the A-listers are looking. It's like, hey, buddy, my eyes are
you
up here.
You swam through a river of shit to get there, to be fair. So.
Yeah. So it was, and there were a lot of like very glamorous people that, you know, weren't worthy to be around.
Not me. That's the takeaway.
Okay. Yeah.
Two tickets,
no,
man.
No,
two
it's
tickets.
Fine. It's fine. It's all good. No, it's fine.
Wow.
Yeah. But it was an interesting show. So this is directed by Kip Williams, who did the Picture of Dorian Gray with Sarah Snook of Succession. You know her. It's a TV show.
I do.
And that was incredible. And they used a lot of the same techniques here because that was also a one-woman show. So there was, you know, the cameras following around on stage, live editing on a screen on stage so she could interact with herself and play different roles against each other and not have to just like Gollum style turn from one camera to the other.
So is some of it like pre-recorded then?
A lot of it's pre-recorded.
Right. Yeah. quite a lot in this case. But they were also sometimes overlaying live footage of Erivo and recorded footage of Erivo as a different character or something. Or even like at one point they're talking about the history of vampires. So they have pictures up on stage of her as a sort of Bela Lugosi Dracula and the Nosferatu kind of incarnation and the Eddie Murphy in A Vampire in Brooklyn incarnation.
Interesting
of
choice.
The vampire.
Yeah.
I would recommend it. I am going back and I you know, I had thoughts beforehand of,
with
oh,
James.
If this is terrible, I could give my ticket to James. And, then, and now I'm thinking, no, I want to see it again. No, I'm slightly kidding.
Yeah.
Who knew Dracula would be the thing that would cause the schism that would tear this podcast apart?
To drive a stake through our heart.
So yes, I would recommend it. I don't think it's as good as The Picture of Dorian Gray, which to be fair is one of the greatest performances
I've seen in my entire life.
No, I wasn't invited to that.
I wasn't invited to that either.
Excuse me, I was invited by someone else who paid for my ticket very kindly, and thank God she did because it was £270 for that one.
No, we're fine.
No one. Yeah, we're good.
Yeah.
We're good.
Anyway, I think this was less good, but that's still, you know, grading on an incredibly high scale, I think. I think Cynthia Erivo is a fantastic, fantastic performer, and I really enjoyed what she did with characters. Some people online were saying they couldn't tell all of them apart, that they weren't clearly delineated. I would disagree respectfully with that. I kind of always knew who she was being.
Keanu Reeves wasn't quite on point, is what you're saying.
I know, we're the bastard slaves.
I did have questions about her Irish accent, but the other ones were pretty good.
Well, she plays Dracula, interesting enough. She I think chooses a Nigerian accent for Dracula.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
That was kind of cool. I think that goes to the idea of like Dracula as like, well, first of all, as a folkloric present, but also as like, the, you know, something that is ancient, that has been there for a very long time. And if you're going back to the roots of humanity in Africa, maybe there's a sort of nod to that, which I thought was quite cool and quite clever and quite interesting. Mm. I think the play generally kind of plays up the idea of, this is a very common one for Dracula adaptations, but like sexual repression. But in this case, particularly, I think queer sexual repression and sort of Dracula representing almost queer liberation, which was kind of an interesting angle, although not exactly radical or revolutionary, I would suggest at this point. But
yes,
but,
I do think
nice.
they do de-evil him.
Very much, in
a way.
It's not scary.
No. It's eerie. I was eared at certain points, but I wasn't scared, but I was eared.
Yeah.
I admired it. I thought it was technically just absolutely astonishing, the way that the giant screens move forward and obscure the set while they do these incredible quick changes behind. And some of the costume changes absolutely, you know, took me by surprise as well. Performance-wise, I think she's fantastic. I just wish that it had been more of a theater piece, I think, than
it's an epistolary novel,
piece.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
It's sort of it's all based on letters, so she's almost more narrating than acting a lot of the time.
She doesn't really I don't think she really addresses the audience until the last 10-15 minutes. It doesn't feel like a conventional one person play until the last 10-15 minutes when the big screens retreat a little bit into the distance. But hey.
I mean, I assume it will be on NT Live or similar to put it in cinemas at some point.
Yes.
So even if you're not coming to London or in London,
James,
I would imagine.
Oh, so I could go on my own and watch it that way. Oh, yeah. I'll do that. Yes, thank you, Helen.
Oh, I'm sorry. Do you need Chris to come and hold your hand?
Yes.
In case
three
it's scary.
Into two doesn't go, Jimbo. And Helen, she goes to all the plays. I felt that she might have been better placed to enjoy it. And it's a Tuesday. You're never around on a Tuesday.
It's fine. It's all fine.
Anyway, should we have a question?
Oh,
let's have
God.
A question.
Finally, let's have a fucking question. This comes from San Julif on Blue Sky, xmance.bsky.social. This week was Pancake Day. I know, and I didn't have a single pancake.
Same, what? And I make banging pancakes.
Do you?
Yes. I even have a special pancake pan just for making pancakes.
Oh, usually you just sit next to the person who's making the pancakes and eat all the cheese
Helen,
that they've perfectly
it's
grated.
Been
and
20 years. How are you not over this yet?
I can see now why she tried to kill you with the car boots.
It all makes sense.
Yes.
Yeah, that's true.
She's just been storing it up for years.
The Dracula snub was, I think, it was a long-delayed revenge for the pancake incident. Yeah.
You had all the toppings.
I ate your cheese. It's true.
All the toppings.
This week was Pancake Day. What's the best fall from a height or flattening of a character in a film?
Black Ooh. Widow.
Black Widow. That was not what I was expecting you to say. You've left a strategic opening for me to say Hans Gruber.
Yeah, that's true.
Yes.
Wait, I don't remember the Black Widow one.
Vormir, John. Vormir.
Fulmer.
She falls off. Fulmer.
She falls off.
The magical
flat
cliff.
Widow.
The magical
listen,
cliff.
I'm not saying that film was somewhat forgettable, but I don't totally remember that.
Sorry.
In this house, sorry.
Whoa. Are you calling Avengers Endgame forgettable?
Oh, I thought you meant the film Black Widow. Right. Okay, I'm with you now. Sorry.
I mean, she may... in fact, she does fall off something in the film Black Widow, but no, I'm not
she
referring
falls off
to
a
that.
Lot of stuff. She's very clumsy.
She is.
No. Avengers Endgame, I remember very well. That's
all right, good.
Yes.
Clearly.
Yeah.
I was about to lunge at you. I don't care.
I like that film a lot.
Scattering computers.
His teeth have actually grown longer, and his nails as well. He was terrifying.
Vormir, right. I'm with you now.
Vormir, yes. But yes. Helen is correct. The correct answer is, of course, Hans Gruber. I would give bonus points for the alien queen, but she falls into a vacuum, so I'm not sure that really counts.
Is it?
There's no
gravity.
That's not
she's
down.
Not
falling.
She's not falling. She's being sucked out and then floats away.
She's falling with style.
It's not really the same.
I don't know that she's falling necessarily, but yes, Natasha Romanoff in Avengers Endgame is a very good one. If you want to, if you want to kill your significant female characters, go to the cliff and form here. Gamora, gone. Natasha Romanoff, gone. What about the blokes? They don't fall off that cliff. Right, Helen?
Yeah.
Yeah, girl power.
No, I'm not giving a high five for
that. No? Okay. No. I'm just, ally.
I appreciate it.
I'm an ally.
Are you? Okay.
All right. I was rebuffed.
You were.
I wanted to throw my weight behind your campaign, but okay. Natasha, that was a good one. Hans Gruber, that's a solid start.
Mm.
That is a solid start. I've got some more, but yes,
okay.
Helen.
How about Dredd also?
Yes.
Mama? Was it Mama?
Anyway, Momo. Is it Momo? I think it was Momo.
Jason Momoa.
Jason Momoa.
Lena Headey is Jason Momoa. Is it Headey or Headey?
I don't remember.
Headey.
Is it Headey? Mm. Lena Headey.
Lena Headey.
It's spelled Headey.
It is.
Oh, it's confusing. Anyway, but she's, spoiler, the bad guy in the movie.
Yeah.
And a big drug dealer. And it's a drug that slows down your perception of time. So when she gets flung off the balcony.
Yeah.
Okay. She experiences probably a whole lifetime on the way down.
Yeah, it's a mega, mega slow-mo fall. And one of the great things about it is when you see a lot of people fall from a great height in a movie and they actually hit the ground, you don't tend to see them hitting the ground. So you don't see Hans Gruber hitting the ground because, they didn't want to kill a stuntman or indeed Alan Rickman. But with Lena Headey? Lena Headey.
And it's Mormo or Mama.
I think it's Mama.
Yeah, I think it's Mama.
It's Emma. It's spelled M-A-M-A. I can't remember how
to pronounce it. If it's Lena Headey, does that mean it's Judge Dredd?
Oh, my God. Yes, Chris, it's Judge Dredd.
So she's been executed by Dredd, and she falls off the balcony. And
The balcony.
Hang on, are we in New Zealand? What's going on? So she falls off the balcony, and she falls a great height. And she falls, and she actually hits the ground, and you see it. Mm. She splatters everywhere.
Like a pancake.
Like a pancake.
Like a pancake.
Like a pancake splatters.
I don't know. Well, it does if you don't properly,
This is never good, Helen's, for pancake day.
Well, there'll be no toppings, so.
Yeah, you're not invited anymore after the way he behaved last time.
All right, that's a good one. John, do you have any?
Well, I do have another one that follows them all the way down as they fall, and that's the other guys.
Yes!
The opening of the other guys.
That's a stunner.
Samuel L. Jackson and The Rock.
Answer. Yes.
And the camera just tracks them as they fall, and then...
Well, they don't fall, they're jumping.
Oh, they're jumping.
Because
aim for the bushes.
Aim for the trees.
They're the tough cops who are unkillable, and they jump off a tall building, and they aim for the bushes, which would catch their fall, but of course, they miscalculate.
and it's like Foo Fighters' Hero is
my
playing.
Hero, yes.
My Hero.
Yeah.
I love that film so
it's,
much.
It's so funny. And you watch the camera stays in a fixed position and tracks them all the way down until they become splats at the bottom. And then it hard cuts their funeral, if I'm right in thinking. It's extraordinary stuff. That is amazing. Jimbo, any more?
300. This is Sparta!
This is vampires!
Kicks him down the hole.
But does he splatter, given that he presumably lands in the water at the bottom of the well?
What's the question? What was the question? Was it splatter?
It was about pancaking, wasn't it? So, I think he just drowned.
Wow.
he just
way to ruin 300.
No.
Helen.
What's the best fall from a height?
Ha-ha.
Okay.
I mean, we don't know how high it was, to be
or
fair.
Or flattening. Oh, that's a well.
I mean, yeah, but it could be a really shallow well.
Flattening. Oh, well.
Well.
Yeah, how about that one in one of the Final Destination movies with the sort of pane of glass or something that just like squishes?
But that's a good one.
It's very flattening.
Well, when I think flattening, I think Austin Powers International Man of Mystery.
Yes. Yes.
That is the ultimate flattening.
With the roller.
The slow motion. Roller. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Oh, Smitty.
Yeah.
Get out the way.
Yeah, yeah. The reveal of that, the, you know, going, get out of the way, and the henchman, the anonymous henchman is screaming. I think it's played by John McDonald, I'm not sure. And he's screaming, and then it cuts, and he's about 50 feet away from him in a very, very slow moving steamroller. If we're talking about steamrollers as well, Vincent Ludwig, the bad guy in The Naked Gun, gets run over by a steamroller and then walked over by a marching band, and there's something else in there that runs him over too.
Judge Doom.
From Judge Dredd.
From Judge Dredd, yes. No, Judge Doom from Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
That's right.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And then he pumps himself back up again.
He does pump himself, which is actually exactly what happened to Hans Gruber at the end of Die Hard. You just don't see it.
I was going to say, you say Roger Rabbit.
Yeah.
Eddie Valiant also has an amazing fall from a great height in that.
He does.
There's a great sequence where he falls a very, very great height. He's in Toontown. Yeah. Mm. Mm-hmm. And Bugs Bunny and Mickey Mouse come along. It's Mickey Mouse's only recorded funny appearance in
true
the
story.
Whole of history. But that's because he's next to Bugs Bunny, who is infinitely funnier than Mickey Mouse.
Well, that's fair.
That is very fair. And then, of course, they have parachutes and they give Eddie Valiant something and it turns out to be a spare tire. And,
yeah.
he falls and then he hits his balls on a flagpole.
And that's what happens when you fall. I would say, fly, you fools. But he doesn't pancake because in an act of physics I've never fully understood, he falls down through the bowels of the earth and ends up on the top of a mountain. Helen, you are the resident Tolkien scholar. What the fuck is going on there?
No, he falls down into the bowels of the earth and then they fight all the way up the endless stair to the top of the mountain.
I fought the beast for 3 days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I don't think Gandalf has the cardio for that. I've got to be honest with you. I'm not seeing it.
He's a literal angel.
I mean,
he's an immortal being from the Valar.
Come on.
James, you may have brought a knife to a gunfight here.
It's true. I'm going to back slowly out of the room without making any sudden movements.
If we're talking about fools, I was always fond of the guy who falls off the end of the Titanic and hits the propeller.
Oh, yes.
What do you mean you were always fond of that, you sicko?
Who doesn't love that guy?
It's just a very memorable death. And also, I really very recently realized that was John Landau, the producer of the film.
What, falling?
It's I read his memoir recently, which he wrote just before he died, and he was digitally scanned and asked to be that guy. So that is John Lando.
Really? That's fun.
Hitting
the propeller.
That's a good fact.
It's a really good little cameo to have.
Ooh, MJ in Spider-Man No Way Home.
Oh.
That's a great, great moment. When he saves her.
Amazing Spider-Man. Okay.
But when he saves, and just the Andrew Garfield, like the tears when he saves her.
That was lovely.
Yeah, are you okay?
Yeah.
Speaking of Spider-Man, Miles Morales in Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, the amazing
sequence.
Where he jumps off the building falls and falls and falls and the camera inverts and the everything goes upside down and he's falling upwards. I believe that's what they said in the script. He's falling upwards.
It's so good.
It's amazing. Absolutely amazing.
Well,
but is he falling? Because I guess he is, he's jumped,
he's
right?
He's definitely falling. He has jumped, but he is falling. I think that's okay because it's nice to end on an upbeat note.
Literally.
Yes.
Upbeat.
Yeah. Yeah, it's nice. Luke Skywalker.
Yes.
Luke.
That is falling with style.
In Cloud City.
Yeah. That's falling with style.
Oh, if we're talking falling with style, then Toy Story.
That's
later.
Not flying. It's falling with style.
Yeah.
Yes. I think Luke's fall is good. Better than the Emperor's fall, which doesn't end as well for him.
Or does it? Because somehow he returned.
He fought the Balrog for 3 days
and ended up on top of a mountain.
Palpatine definitely doesn't have the cardio to do that.
No.
I would say.
It does have unlimited power.
Unlimited pancakes.
Ooh.
I'd love unlimited pancakes.
Come to Emperor Palpatine's pancake shop. Unlimited pancakes. Buttercream.
Buttercream. Buttercream.
What are you putting in your pancakes?
No.
You make the pancakes with butter. Anyway, sharp. Lois Lane. You've got me.
Who's got you?
She falls off the Daily Planet in
that was pretty cool.
The original and best Superman. And then she's falling. Oh, no. Lois Lane's about to turn into Lois cul-de-sac, and, you know,
Lois
and then
two
splat.
Plane,
yes. Lois splat. It's not even a pun, but...
It's not. But it is accurate.
It is accurate. And then who flies up to save her?
Batman.
Bloody Chris Reeve. It's amazing. Absolutely amazing. All right, two more.
Okay.
I'm not really... I don't have that many flattens. Like proper people being crushed by things. I'm more about the falling. And two more for me. Tim Robbins in the Hudsucker Proxy.
Oh, yeah, oh, all wow, of them yeah. in the Hudsucker Proxy, really. But yeah.
Yeah.
That's a great one.
That's a banger where he falls and falls and falls and falls and then time stops around him so he doesn't actually die. And then, of course, the beginning of Cliffhanger.
Oh, too soon.
Oof.
Too soon?
Too soon. Definitely too soon.
Still too soon. Always too soon. It's only been like, what, 35 years or something?
Although I do think the best falling is Loki for Ragnarok.
I've been falling for 30 minutes! Listen, we could talk about people falling and being turned into pancakes and men's fashions all day, but sadly we have to crack on with the rest of the podcast. God knows we've taken long enough in this section already. But there you go. Thank you so much indeed to that person who sent in the question, whose name was San Julif. Thank you so much indeed. And keep in peel for panic shoutouts next week. Okay, and time now to talk about the movie news of the week. I think there's only one place to start. We have lost yet another legend. The wonderful Robert Duvall edged to slip this week, just five short of his century. He was 95. Hell of an innings, Jimbo.
Yes, very, very, very upsetting. Although, to be fair, he had a good innings.
Mm. A great innings.
But Tom Hagen from The Godfather, Kilgore from... Apocalypse Now.
Yeah.
Absolute legend. I very, very nearly interviewed him once and was ushered out of the room before the interview could start.
What? What happened?
So I flew all the way to New York to interview the legendary Robert Duvall and James Caan. They were sitting together in the room. I came in. I was next. I went to sit down. They went, I'm sorry, that's all we've got time for.
No.
And they shut down and I never got to speak to them. So I saw him from afar and we locked eyes. So that's...
What happened?
We shared a moment. Do you know what? I guess the schedules changed, but so I flew all the way out there for nothing.
Oh, no.
This is for the Godfather or for a...
It was a Godfather interview, yes.
Wow.
Yes, it was a Godfather.
What anniversary?
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't. It was actually for the Godfather video game.
The Godfather video game, yeah, which I'm guessing things. Robert Duvall never played. Jimmy Caan, maybe.
I don't imagine he did.
But I'm guessing Robert Duvall never played. But yeah.
Yeah. I spoke to him for The Judge.
Did you?
Did
you? He's really good in that.
He was very good in that. And he was a very fun interview. I mean, it was, you know, he definitely was very much living in the present. I was all like, so tell me about To Kill a Mockingbird. And he's all like, so how about no? I mean, in the politest and nicest way possible a little bit. But, you know, he was still very, very lively. He must have been 85 nearly at that point.
And, The Judge.
Yeah, it was what, 2015 or so?
Yeah, it would have been around.
And but he was, you know, still tangoing regularly and just seemed absolutely full of beans. So I think he's a guy who really had a zest for life and was very much living in the moment and not just dining out on his incredible back catalogue, which quite frankly many a lesser actor would have done.
Yes.
But I mean, but genuinely, he was, you know, he was in To Kill a Mockingbird, which is a big, big film for me. It was one of his very first films. I think he had a couple of, it's called his film debut, but I think there were a couple of tiny cameo roles
He's Boo
beforehand.
Radley in that.
But he is Boo Radley, yeah. Yes.
So he inspired a top band as well.
He definitely, sure. I'm not sure it was him personally. I think it might have been the book, but yeah, no, it's a lovely little part, and I think he does it very, very beautifully. And but yeah, that was like just a tiny hint of what was to come. Mm. And I think, you know, there were a couple of, just fabulous obituaries and memories of him published this week, but people talking about how he really could run the gamut. Like something like Kilgore is a really big performance, mm-hmm. whereas Hagen is so controlled and quiet, and he's just sitting in the corner a lot of the time, just listening and processing and just... He's like the Mentats in Dune, James. Like well, he is like the human computer.
What are they if
like,
not consiliaries?
Exactly. Mm. And he's just like sitting there processing everything going on, you know, spotting the weaknesses and the flaws of everybody else and just absolutely ruthless when he needs to be.
I never read Tom Hagen as that at all.
Really?
This is why they stand him down in Godfather 2.
He's not a wartime consigliere.
That's true.
He's too nice for that game. He's a good guy. Of course, famously, Duvall, they wanted him back for Godfather 3 and they didn't offer him what he thought he was worth. And yeah, absolutely. And he was replaced, not in the same role, but by George Hamilton. But I interviewed him twice, as it turns out.
Nice.
Both for the same film. I remember interviewing him, one of which I completely forgot had happened. I went looking through my archives this week. I remember interviewing him in person for Jack Reacher when he came over to London. It was one of those really, really brief, like, 10 minutes, if that, TV slots, which are awful. But, you know, you still got a sense of what a lovely guy he was and how affable he was. But it turns out also I did a pint of milk with him, which I'd completely forgotten. And when he found out, when I looked through my archives, I was like, oh, shit, I interviewed Robert. I did pint of milk with Robert Duvall. I didn't ask him how hairy his ass was. I drew the line. I didn't ask De Niro either, but hey-ho. And... you know, that brief, 27 minutes? I think I really understood the man.
I'm sure you did. Did he know how much a pint of milk was?
He did. He was a big football fan, so we talked a lot about, because he directed a film called A Shot of Glory.
With Ali McCoist.
Oh, wow. He's in it as well. Duvall's in it also. It's not available on streaming. It is available on YouTube. It's a very, very interesting movie. That's not what I want to talk about when I talk about Robert Duvall, but it is an interesting, just this curio in his CV. But John, what do you think of when you think of Robert Duvall?
Well, I mean, probably the things everyone thinks of is Apocalypse Now and The Godfather. But I mean, he did so much work with, you know, George Lucas and Francis Ford Coppola. And he's one of those actors.
He's in the conversation.
He is in the conversation, yes. He just seems like one of those actors that's always been working, you know, like he never sort of stopped. He was always, you know, popping up in things. I was always weirdly a fan of his work in Gone in 60 Seconds.
I read someone say this week, he was so good that he was good in Deep Impact.
Yeah, there you go.
Honestly, you come for Deep Impact.
I was thinking of him in Deep Impact. But that's one of the first major roles I probably saw him in as a kid. Yeah.
Really?
You know, well, because I wasn't sitting at like 10 or 11 watching The Godfather. I was, you know, watching like big, stupid mainstream things about, you know, asteroids. And I thought he was really good. But that was the era where, you're right, he would just class up the joint of these, you know, big blockbustery films.
As Spurgeon Tanner.
Spurgeon Tanner.
That's his character name.
Genuinely
Spurgeon
fabulous name.
Tanner. He saves the world.
They all have. They're all going to have high schools named after them. Do you remember that? It's not bad. He's good in Network as well.
Except John Favreau, who's still floating off in space. Is that falling with style? I don't know.
And I mean, what was it? 7 Oscar nominations. He won for Tender Mercies, which I feel like is not the film he's remembered for.
Can I make a confession?
Yeah.
I've never seen Tender Mercies, and I feel I have to rectify this immediately.
I feel like I do too. I think I saw it on TV once, because when I read the synopsis, I was like, oh, yes. But then I was wondering afterwards, do I just think I've seen it because it sounds exactly like the one that Jeff Bridges won the Oscar for?
Which Robert Duvall was also in.
Oh my God, yes. Crazy Heart.
Crazy Heart.
Shit, I hadn't put that together. Anyway, but yeah, I think he probably should have won for one of the others, if I'm honest. I mean, The Apostle, which he also directed and wrote, I think.
Fantastic.
Is pretty incredible.
Yeah.
I just feel like he was one of those guys who, even if he wasn't the lead, and I'm glad that he got the chance to lead some films and he wasn't just stuck as, I think people described him as America's number one, number two at one point in the 70s. Like if he was second on the call sheet, you knew you were in good hands. And he kind of, I think, went away slightly and did some Broadway and tried to kind of reestablish himself as a leading man and not just a great character actor. And I'm glad that he got some leading roles and some of them were great. But at the same time, like, if all you were being is, you know, the eye-catching dude in The Godfather, geez, that's okay, isn't it?
Standout, I think, because he is a standout in The Godfather and The Godfather 2. And I always felt Tom to be a really strangely reassuring presence in those movies. He may be the only bloke in The Godfather movies who doesn't actually murder anyone. I'm trying to think.
Because he has Fredo a humility doesn't. To him. Like when he goes to Jack Waltz and he, let's be honest, threatens him. But he does it in the most amicable, polite, and quite charming way.
Charming way, yeah.
Business-like. Right up until the horse's head.
Do you think Tom cut the horse's head off himself?
No, I don't think he does things like that himself.
Yeah.
You know what Luca Brasi's for.
It's an old Sicilian message. Luca Brasi sleeps with the horses.
Oh, no.
So he was nominated Best Supporting Actor, Godfather, Best Supporting Actor, Apocalypse Now, Best Leading Actor for The Great Santini, won for Tender Mercies, nominated Best Actor for The Apostle, Supporting Actor for A Civil Action, a fairly forgettable John Travolta legal drama. Mm-hmm. And speaking of fairly forgettable legal dramas, he was also nominated for The Judge as well. But I genuinely think he was in the conversation, the movie, and he's in the conversation genuinely, I think, for one of the greatest of all time.
Mm.
Yeah. And I really loved the statement that his family put out. I don't know if you saw this after he died. They said there would be no formal service for him, but they encourage those who wish to honor his memory to do so in a way that reflects the life he lived by watching a great film, telling a good story around the table with friends, or taking a drive in the countryside to appreciate the world's beauty.
Right. All of us gone in 60 seconds this afternoon. It's what he would have wanted.
Is that the spirit of that?
Yes.
Sorry, a shot of glory, surely.
The first thing was...
By watching a great film.
By watching a great film.
I understood the assignment, thank you.
not a sort of shaggy three-star from the 90s.
Hey.
Which I appreciate very much.
Mm.
But come on.
Come on.
Also, just last night, we lost Tom Noonan, the Tooth Fairy himself from Michael Mann's Manhunter.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. I'd forgotten that was him.
Yeah.
Dollarhide.
Yeah, he's the Francis Dollarhide in that. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Also, the scary serial killer from Last Action Hero. Mm-hmm. What's the guy called? The Axe?
The
Axe
Man?
The Ripper?
The Ripper.
The Ripper. A great, great character actor. He passed away at the age of 74. He was absolutely terrific. He was Kane in RoboCop 2 as well. He shows up briefly also for Michael Mann in Heat. He was absolutely terrific and he will be much missed. What else has happened?
There have been some trailers. There was one for the film, I believe it's known as Din Djarin and Baby Yoda.
Something like that, yeah.
I believe that's what it's called. Now, I when the first trailer for this came out, my feelings towards it were, I like it, I'm excited about it, it feels like an episode of the TV show.
Mm-hmm.
So my question to you, Helen, is how do you feel about the second one and do you think it feels more cinematic?
Yes, I think it feels bigger. I think they've leaned into the Star Warsiness of it all. With this episode, you know, it feels like they're getting a little... There's almost a theme crossover, musically speaking. They've taken, you know, the Goranson theme, but also mixed in some Star Wars sort of main...
So it feels bigger.
So it feels bigger, broader. Just from that. Yeah. And then you've got like some big monsters and you've got some huts, obviously, and you've got just a bit more scale. You also, crucially, have brought in and attracted a demographic by taking his fucking helmet off. Now, this is not a spoiler. It's all over this trailer.
This is not the way, Helen.
I know it's not the way. And yet, you know, his helmet is removed from him against his will, I think, initially. Mm. And then he just seems to go with it. He's like, shit, I'm real handsome under here. Maybe I
think
should
he's
just
aware
lean
of
in.
How handsome he is.
I mean, I don't know. Why then does he wear the helmet all
because
the time?
Because this is the way, Helen.
I think you should find a different way.
It doesn't matter how hot you are. If you're a Mandalorian, you got to keep your helmet on.
I think it's good that Jon Favreau found a way to get Pedro Pascal to come to the set. So that's, you know, this is good that he's managed to take the helmet off. It's good to see his face.
It's a good face.
Canonically, I think he is moving, because bearing in mind, so he's a Death Watch Mandalorian, so he's a religious fundamentalist.
Yes.
So, I think we'd even seen in the show, he's starting to move away from those slightly hardcore fanatical beliefs. So it does make sense.
It does have a character. Yeah, I agree with that completely. I think it has a character and a sort of thematic purpose to it, potentially. And it also just allows a little bit more of the interaction with Grogu, which is super cute here. I enjoy that he's still pushing buttons and being a force for chaos. I enjoy that he still enjoys a good pram.
And a macaroon.
And he gets quite cross when he's told not to stop eating and not to ruin his appetite. I enjoyed that. I thought, I just thought it was cute.
Yeah.
John, did this land with you?
I mean, I liked it more than the last trailer. I'm relieved that they remembered to hire a cinematographer.
Is it the same thing that, because I did have this with the first one. I thought, this feels small. It feels like television. Yeah. It doesn't feel like cinema. Because, and I've said this before, when I went back to Rogue One at the end of Andor, it did make me realize that Star Wars films, there is a breadth to the canvas. There is a grandeur to them, which, even though Andor is arguably the best thing Star Wars has ever done, like, the TV shows as a rule haven't had that grandeur. Andor's the closest that's come to it, obviously, but they felt quite small.
And Andor at least shot on location, not volume.
I think that's the big reason. I really do. I think the location shoots make such a difference.
Yeah, there are some really nice shots in this trailer. The first trailer, it looked like it was lit by, you know, they had the big lights on or something. Like, it just felt a little bit flat for me. This feels a bit more like meaty, proper old-school Star Wars. Yeah. So I'm a bit more optimistic.
It's starting to feel like it's now starting to feel to me like this could be an event, because I'd come into this thinking this was, it's like a feature-length episode of the series.
Yeah.
But actually, I'm now starting to, is this a Star Wars movie after 7 years?
No,
sorry,
it's not.
Sorry, 7 years. Sorry, I forgot that there was not a film after.
It's with 9 years. 9 years, right?
Yeah, nine years. It's definitely 9 years.
When was, really?
Yeah. Since The Last Jedi, The Last...
So there wasn't, like, Solo wasn't after that?
No, and there was Solo, Rogue One, and then The Last Jedi, and then they just stopped.
And then they never made another one after that.
And so now they're back with The Mandalorian and Grogu. Did this shed any light on what the story of this film is? Are we a little bit clearer about what's happening, or are they just titting around the universe?
I think it's, as far as I can tell, it's a bunch of slugs having a big fight or something. It's just...
It's like the WWE hut stuff was a move. That feels quite Filoni-esque, all that stuff. It feels like it leans very heavily into kind of like the Clone Wars type sort of sensibility. But you do also get Din Djarin trying to track down a hut and asking Martin Scorsese, which of course is what you do, right? If you want to find a hut, so.
Yes, because Martin Scorsese is voicing a CG character in this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he's in the trailer.
And he's got the eyebrows. And
he
everything.
Does have the eyebrows. It literally looks like Martin Scorsese. Yeah. It's
so
amazing.
Yeah. Wait, this is cinema?
Yes.
This is cinema. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you've got, you know, Sigourney Weaver providing a voice of reason, it sounds like. Counsel? Advice?
I don't trust her.
Wow.
I don't trust her. Yeah. I think she's up to no good. She usually is these days.
And you're up to no good.
In fairness. Yeah.
Shifty.
Since the whole Sewell thing, I just don't think she could be trusted.
Tell you this. She went to see something at the theatre. She wouldn't invite you.
I did go to see Sigourney Weaver at the theatre.
I went to see Sigourney Weaver.
You
at the
did,
theater.
Didn't you? Yeah. This was The Tempest, wasn't it?
Yeah. And I was delighted to see her, but it was a terrible production.
Yeah, it was dreadful. By the way, I saw High Noon the other week as well. Also not very good.
It was...
Chris's Theatre Reviews! it looks good. I think I'm more on board for this than you are, because I really like the Mandalorian show, and I'm glad that it's getting away from the Mandalorian lore that bogged down the show in the third season.
Yeah, that was not its high point.
Because the reason why we love that show is because it's a stoic warrior who never takes his helmet off, but is always played by Pedro Pascal, titting around the universe with a cute little baby Yoda. Yeah, and they seem to have gone...
I want to see the baby.
Give the people what they want. They want to see the baby. Would you like a libation before you go to see The Mandalorian and Grogu?
Yes.
Yes, indeed. So this looks like a ton of fun, and it's just good to have a Star Wars back on the big screen.
Absolutely.
It is. I'm very on board with this.
Yeah, fantastic. Good stuff. Well done, everybody. You said there was another trailer?
I mean, there was another trailer. In fact, two trailers, because Spider-Noir, the new Nicolas Cage live-action sort of, I was about to say Marvel TV show. It is a Marvel TV show. It's a Sony TV show, not a Disney TV show, but it is a Marvel TV show. It's a Spider-Man TV show. It's Spider-Noir, which is obviously the character that he voices in.
Is this Spunk?
It is. Well, it's not, Spunk
it is.
No longer exists.
No.
But it's Sony-owned, isn't it? So it's very confusing. Anyway, so if I said there are two trailers of this, is what it's interesting. There is the Spider-Noir version in the noir-esque black and white. And then for stupid people, there is a colorized, it's not colorized actually, it was shot in color. It's a color version of it. So you can watch it in black and white or you can watch it in color, and you're going to be able to watch the show in either black and white on color as well. And to be fair, the color stuff does look good, but I do think it loses quite a lot. Like, as in, obviously, it gains color, but the noir. Thank you. Yeah.
Are you okay, James?
I may be having a stroke. The noirness of it, I think, really comes across in the black and white. And it looks really, really effective. So I think that's definitely the way it's designed to be seen. It's almost as if Sony executives said, younger audiences won't want something in black and white. We should probably present it in color as well, dear marketing folks. I can't really speak to their strategy, but that seems possible.
Can I say that my big surprise with this trailer was not, oh, it's in black and white, or oh, it's in color. It was, oh, it's live action and not, you know, animation. Because he was cool as an animated character. And much as we love Nicolas Cage's face, I was quite fine with just having his voice. So, yeah, that's a thing.
But you can have his face now in black and white or color.
I mean, wow.
So is what you choose basically a statement about yourself?
Yes.
So, John, you'll go black and white, right?
Of course.
Yeah.
And also, he'll change the language to something like Latvian and just read the subtitles. That's what he'll do. 100%.
Wow.
No, I think, do you know what? I think you do need the American of it. You need the hard-boiled 1940s private dick sort of. I want to feel like I'm watching a Raymond Chandler adaptation or something, you know? It needs to feel like, I do think they've done a very good job of like bringing out those noir tropes.
But you do lose them a bit in the color version. Like it doesn't feel right.
Yeah.
It's a strange one, because I watched the color trailer first, then went back and I was like, oh, right, now I get it. Like when I saw the black and white one, I was like, okay, this is how they want you to see it.
Yeah, I'm excited for it. I think it's a good looking thing. I don't know. I hope it's just well written, has a story. I like, you know, Nicolas Cage, obviously. I like Lamorne Morris, who's in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is exciting.
This is cinema. It's not, because it's TV.
Yeah.
Lord and Miller are producing. I don't think they're show running. I think it's Orion Uziel who's done a lot of work with them. But it's got their hands all over it.
And they're premature.
Their dabs are all over it. Spider-Noir, it is on Prime Video soon, right? Like
soon,
a month and a half or something?
Yeah,
like 2 months,
off.
3 months,
we'll be
4 months.
Reviewing it on the Pilot TV podcast.
And indeed the Empire podcast probably as well. But we shall see. One thing we'll be reviewing on the Empire podcast when it gets made, and it is getting made very, very soon, is a film that made quite a splash this week when it was announced. It is called simply Jason Statham Stole My Bike,
yes.
And it will star Jason Statham as, and this is a stretch,
the bicycle thief.
Jason Statham.
This is perhaps the greatest thing that cinema has ever brought us. So thank you to David Leitch for making this film. But it is Jason Statham playing Jason Statham in Jason Statham Stole My Bike, a film in which I can only assume Jason Statham steals someone's bike.
Maybe he steals all our bikes.
He may steal all the bikes. Yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, who is this my... You know, this first person in the title.
Whose bike
Perhaps
is stolen?
Perhaps it is all of us. Mm.
Jason Statham stole our collective bike.
Yeah, if you're going to be meta, go meta, you know. I'm super here for this. I enjoy Jason Statham making fun of himself, which I assume and hope and believe is what is going to happen in this film. I think, like, if it's basically those scenes in Spy... You know,
oh my God.
Times 10, 100% on board.
Can I just recommend anyone with access to YouTube, look up the outtakes from those, because they are, he'll say something that makes absolutely no sense. It's completely ridiculous. And they just burst out laughing.
Yeah.
It's
brilliant. And you can hear Paul Feig in the background feeding him lines.
Yes. And he's just reading, it's like, what the fuck
and he goes,
is this?
What is it? Some of those lines are ridiculous.
Genius.
I've swallowed enough computer chips and shat them out again to build a computer. I sewed on my own arm with my other arm. Melissa McCarthy's sitting there going, I don't think that's possible.
Oh, good stuff. So this is going to be apparently a big budget action comedy. I'm guessing that Maya is a kid. I'm guessing this is probably a kid who thinks this Jason Statham stole his bike and then goes on a... I'm guessing they haven't released a logline, but I'm from the title, this is what I'm extrapolating, and then goes on a campaign to get Jason Statham to give them their bike back, and then it leads to hijinks and shootouts and all sorts of stuff.
Fantastic.
So, sounds good to me. Well done, everybody. Time now for this week's guests. Yes?
Yes.
Yes, 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 yes. The Secret Agent is the Brazilian movie that is making all kinds of waves in the Oscar conversation. Can you make waves in a conversation? You can, and it is. It's a film set in the military dictatorship in Brazil in the late 70s, and it follows Wagner Moura's Marcelo, who is a tech researcher who takes refuge in the Brazilian city of I've never pronounced his name before, so I'm probably getting it very, very wrong. And I apologize to all my Brazilian friends. Recife. I'm going to say Recife. And this is a sprawling, fantastic epic. We've given it 5 stars. We'll talk about it in the review section in just a few minutes. But it is directed by Kleber Mondonca Filho and stars, of course, Wagner Moura. It has been nominated for Best Picture, and Wagner Moura has been nominated for Best Actor and may well win. And you never know. And so we were delighted to talk to the two of them when they came into London recently. And Harry Stainer, who loves this movie, went along and had a lovely chat with them. Here you go. Do please enjoy.
So yeah, I first saw this film at the London Film Festival and was completely blown away by it. It's set against the backdrop of the 1970s dictatorship in Brazil and explores interesting ideas around memory and time. But what I wasn't expecting was that there was this deep love of cinema running through it, especially among all things, the film Jaws. So to keep with the theme of memory, I just wanted to know, when did you both first watch Jaws and what was your memory of it?
The first time I actually saw Jaws was in 1983 on VHS. But I have to say that when I was about 9, which is 1977, I started seeing the poster for Jaws in many cinemas in downtown Recife. Not only the poster, but lobby cards. Each at the time, the poster came with 2 lobby cards on the right side. And that really played with the kids' imagination, the artwork, you know, the jaws coming from beneath and the swimmer on the top. And that was so strong, and it just played with my imagination. So it really felt like it was my first contact with the film, even if I didn't actually watch it. And the film was rated 14 at the time, and I wasn't allowed to see it.
How can you remember that? You know, how do you remember that you watched it in 83?
Oh, it's very easy. It's easy because we had just moved to England. My mother came to study in England, and we saw Jaws at a friend's house in London. And it was actually the first ever film I saw on VHS.
Oh, that's okay.
It was rented by our friend, and it was Jaws. And we had the great screening in the living room. And
the VHS time was so magical, wasn't it? Like I remember when we acquired our first VHS, my father bought it, and the idea of going to a rental place and renting films,
bringing a film in a bag
home, that was fantastic.
That's how it felt. And soon after we saw Jaws, we bought our first VCR in England. And that's 1983.
Okay, so I guess that memory of having like wanting to see Jaws and then the VCR is kind of how the film kind of bled its way into this film, I guess. Is there Wagner as well? Is there any films that you kind of like hold on to in terms of like VHSs or memories from that time?
Yeah, The Exorcist. I remember that I saw in my VCR, and that was one that I saw it by myself, and I shouldn't have done that because it was very, very scary.
But I have to say that Jaws, of course, besides, you know, my own watching it in 1983, it became a major cultural phenomenon in the 1970s, of course, and also in the city of Recife, because Recife is a beach city. And it ruined a whole generation in terms of going to the beach and swimming on the beach. And besides that, Recife also has a real shark problem. So it wasn't too hard to bring the shark element into the film and, of course, mention the cultural landmark that Jaws is, and also mix it with my feelings of being a local dealing with the fear of sharks on this lovely beach we have.
I can see why, in terms of if it's become like such an ingrained part of your childhood, how it then kind of seeps into the film. I also was talking like thinking in terms of iconic films. When I watched the film, was thinking about the title, The Secret Agent, like a ridiculous amount, and I was just like, this film title would sit like so well along so many like 1970s political thrillers, like 3 Days of the Condor, All the President's Men, The Parallax View, films that could have been playing in the cinema within the film.
Yeah.
And it made me think about how like the title itself feels like quite a self-aware with how we engage with memory, because we remember those films as like sleek and stylish, but the reality of the world is like violent and brutal and terrifying as it is in this film. Was that contrast something you were like consciously playing it with when you like came up with the title? Is that like something you thought of?
Well, the first thing is The Secret Agent is a short and very sexy title. That's the first thing. The second thing is, I guess I make the films I make today, they come from the films that made me want to make films. And as much as I admire many contemporary films, I keep going back to the films, the original films that made me want to make films. And many of them come from the past, you know, from 50s, 60s, 70s, of course. Some people get annoyed at the whole 70s thing. Some people see it as fetish. I don't think it is, not for me anyway. You know, I remember I look at a film like Nashville, for instance, or McCabe and Mrs. Miller, or Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Jaws, Heaven's Gate, which was released in 1980. I really like the style of those films. I like the how frank many of those films are, even if, you know, in the case of Close Encounters, it's a sci-fi fantasy in a way, but it's very frank and it's very well shot, and I like the style of it. You know, I love Duel, Spielberg's first experience of making a television movie, which was so amazing that it got a theatrical distribution internationally. So these films, they really showed me one interesting way in my mind to make films, and that's how I can explain the style. And of course, the 70s was a time of paranoia and of surveillance. It's a very analog time also, very far away from the digital world we have today. And you know, tapes, recordings, photographs, newspapers. So those become interesting elements, narrative elements for the film. That's why so many people associate The Secret Agent with the films from that era, is because it's deeply rooted in the 70s.
I wonder if that idea of memory also like extends beyond the cinema to how we remember like places and countries, especially with how like we look through like our history a lot through like rose-tinted glasses. Like we recently had 28 Years Later, which touches on the way like nations mythologize their past, especially in that context of like UK history. Mm-hmm. And I kind of just wanted to ask you both, like, do you feel like The Secret Agent works as like a reminder of Brazil's history that risks kind of being like softened or forgotten, because we often do tend to look back at times of like political upheaval and often like changing times through like a bit of a lens, when actually the reality is a lot more scary and things that we should learn from?
Well, I don't really remember a Brazilian film that looks at the past with a kind of a romantic. It's usually there is usually a going back to the past in Brazilian life with it's usually through kind of historical lenses. And I wanted to give The Secret Agent this very true sense of life, you know, lived in life, as if we had actually taken a time machine back to 1977. And so not everything that you see in the film is bleak and violent. You see people living their lives and falling in love and being affectionate to one another. And then you also see violence and brutality and disregard for human life, which I think it's part of the world, and you can see the world today and just look at the news. So, but you know, we're living our lives, and I think I don't see a lot of romanticism in The Secret Agent, but you see life being lived, and that's something that I really wanted to go for.
No, I also think as well that that kind of life being lived aspect, when I left the cinema, it kind of just, it kind of played around in my head for like days. This is like the first time in a while where I've left a film where like, I just was like replaying parts of the film, the lovely moments as well as also the more brutal moments.
Yeah.
And Wagner, I just wanted to ask, so the last time this happened for me was actually when I watched Civil War, another film that like constantly played in my head. And they're both films that kind of tackle the effects of political upheaval in very different ways. Like I think in Civil War, your character is very much drawn into conflict, and Armando is obviously trying to escape it here. They make a very interesting double bill, I'd feel. And the look at how political tensions like shape individuals. I was wondering, is it like, are you drawn to these kind of like politically charged stories for a reason, or is it more the characters themselves that kind of bring you into them?
I think that it's only natural that I'm very interested in, I mean, I'm a political person, I mean, interested in politics. It's just natural that I'm drawn to projects that are also political. But also, of course, I mean, when the politics are in front of everything, then it's not fun. You know, I think that you have to be, you have to have characters. The characters should be the thing that will open up a universe of for you to live in. You know, like it's the if the characters are not interested in multi-dimension and you know, like Kleber said, like if they're not living their lives and if we don't see ourselves in the characters, then the politics is not interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that the door is opened by the humanity of the characters. And then you present, you know, a historic moment or politics or, but of course I am drawn to projects like that. And I think that there is a conversation between Civil War, which is a film about the aftermath of a polarized situation with the Secret Agent, which is it's a film based on something that it really happened, which was a dictatorship that we were under in Brazil from 64 to 85.
I guess like looking back on both the projects, is there anything that stayed with you about inhibiting these like very, they're like very different ways of witnessing conflict, I guess, political conflict. Is there anything like that stayed with you from both these experiences?
They're very different films, very different experiences in terms of filming. Civil War was a very tough film to shoot. It wasn't very pleasant to do it, although I loved the film. I watched the film and it's interesting how films, they don't reflect the process, right? In the case of The Secret Agent, it was interesting because I was very happy throughout the entire process and the film ended up being great. But sometimes you're very happy shooting a film and the film ended up not being that great, you know. For me, The Secret Agent was very special because I was being chased. I've been chasing Kleber for a while and we've been trying to work together for a while. And this was the first time that I worked in Portuguese, speaking my own language in 12 years. That was very special in that sense too. And we are very happy with all the attention that we're receiving with this film. Basically because it is a Brazilian film receiving all this attention from any awards a season. By the way, I think that Civil War is a film that should have received more attention than it did.
It was a very popular film.
But in
the award season, you know, like, yeah, it wasn't considered for anything. It wasn't, not even the technical. The sound in that film is so fucking great, you know, and also Kirsten Dunst's work. You know, I think that, I don't know how these things are, you know, but I think that it should have received more attention than.
No, I feel the same about, I feel similar to this in terms of like, they're both films that have really stuck with me, and Civil War is a film that I've gone back to. And I feel like this is a film I'm going to go back to, where every time I've gone back to it, I feel like I get something more out of it. And it's great to see filmmakers making these like strong political films. I also wanted to mention, you mentioned you wanted to work together for a while. So is it true that you both met at Cannes like 20 years ago?
Yeah.
Yeah. What was about this one that brought you finally together then? What was it about The Secret Agent?
I think it takes a while to get something going. I think I realized that I really needed to sit down and write a script for Wagner. That's one way to make it work, because my other films, for example, Bacurau and Neighboring Sounds, they're ensemble pieces. And slowly I came to develop the characters. And then I found the casting. But this one is, I think it's closer to Aquarius because you have one main character. The only thing is I never wrote Aquarius for Sonia. Sonia was a brilliant idea that came about after I had the script.
Whose idea was that? Was it you?
I'm sorry?
Whose idea was
it? It was Pedro Sotero's idea. We were in my place, friends on Friday evening and drinking, and he said it. And I thought, yes, 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 yes. And then it worked. But with Wagner, I really sat down and wrote the script thinking of Wagner as an actor, of what he had done before, of him as a person. And I think it was a pretty good fit.
I think so too.
I believe that is all we have time for, but congratulations on the film. Thank you so much for your time. And I'm sure I'm going to watch it again very soon. So have a lovely day, guys. Take care.
Lovely talking to you, man. Thank you.
Okay, that was Wagner Moura and Kleber Mendonca Filho. And again, my apologies if I've absolutely mangled the pronunciation of those names. But let's talk about The Secret Agent right now, shall we? Hell's bells.
So this is, as you said, about Wagner Moura's character, who is a man called Armando, although he's going by Marcello. and he is traveling to Recife for reasons that are not initially clear. And it becomes gradually clear that he has fallen foul of the regime somehow, and that he is kind of going there as a kind of way station before he can be smuggled out of the country. There are various complications, which again, I won't get into, in terms of getting him out. There's an element of paranoia throughout this. He's going by an assumed name. He's, you know, getting a job so he can kind of lie low. He's got a flat so he can lie low. The flat, for example, where he's living used to belong to his landlady's niece, who was murdered. And there's just this pervasive air of potential violence basically around him at all times. One of the opening shots of the film is him pulling in to get fuel at a petrol station or a gas station, if you're American, on the way to Recife. And there's just a dead body lying there on the side of the road. And it's been there for a couple of days and no one has come to claim it. So this is a country where violence is everywhere, but the sort of social order, I guess, has kind of broken down. Like, the police are so busy killing people and causing havoc that they're not necessarily doing their jobs and keeping, you know, literally picking up bodies and investigating murders. So it's clear that something is very, very rotten in the state of Brazil at this point. And really, that's kind of the film. This is not a film that leans into the kind of the events of living in a paranoid state. It's not about chases and secret midnight meetings, although there's a bit of both. It's not about murders and bodies being discovered, although there is a bit of both. It's about just the pervasive fear and unrest and unease that creates in everyone, however loosely connected to the regime they might be. And it's a kind of a weird film. Like, it does go off on this completely bizarre tangent about a body that someone has tried to dispose of at sea that's been eaten by a shark, and the shark was then fished up. And so when they cut the shark open, they find these body parts, and that's kind of started a murder investigation, which the police are then trying to quell because clearly they're involved. But, like, so there's a kind of surreal thing going on there, and this missing leg of this disembodied leg that was in the shark's belly at one point goes on a little adventure of its own, and it's very strange. So it's not a film that's always grounded in reality.
Right.
But it is a film that doesn't let you forget that something is very badly wrong. And it's a very strange film. I'm thrilled to see it, you know, up for Oscars. It's quite long. It's well over 2 hours, nearer three. It's 161 minutes. The Wagner Moura performance in this is absolutely off the scale great. A lot of it is sort of just sitting and witnessing what's happening. He's not always, you know, agitating. He's not always going out and making himself the focus of events. But he is so, there's so much compassion in his story. And so, and you're so sympathetic to him and everything he's been through. And I think he's just this magnetic presence, even when he's just sort of sitting to one side in a scene. I think he's absolutely incredible in it. So I'm thrilled to see him pick up the Oscar nomination as well.
Okay, so it feels actually you're a little bit more mixed on it than we are. We give it 5 stars. No, why do we give this 5 stars?
I wouldn't even argue with the 5 stars. I'm okay. Just sort of saying that it's not maybe what you expect. You know, this is not... I don't understand why it made some of the decisions it did, but I was entertained by them, so I don't care. Right? And so I wouldn't disagree with 5 stars. I might be more 4.5, but only slightly. I'm not... I don't have any strong objection to 5 stars because I think it's incredible.
Okay, well, we give it 5 stars. 5 stars then for The Secret Agent. Very exciting indeed. Jimbo.
Hello, Chris.
Sorry. Tin Jim.
No, absolutely not.
Tin Jim, good luck. Have fun. Don't die.
That's a good thing to say to me before every review, quite frankly. But this is the new Gore Verbinski film, which is exciting because it's been, what, 10 years since Cure for Wellness?
Yeah.
He's been in director jail for a while, but he has been paroled and he's back now with this. And so this phrase, good luck, have fun, don't die, I am reliably informed by the kids, is something that gamers say on the internet. So make of that what you will. But this
well, you're
is,
a gamer on the internet, aren't
yeah.
you?
I am, but I've never encountered this. But then I try not to talk to people if at all possible on the internet.
Yes, of course.
Because, you know, they're frightening. Mm.
Just kill them from a distance.
Indeed, exactly, which I think is good advice. But this this stars your man, Sam Rockwell, as a time-traveling person from the future. And he arrives in a diner wearing an outfit that looks a lot like Bruce Willis might have worn it in 12 Monkeys. And he tells the patrons in the diner that they have a one chance to save the world. I say one chance. He's done it 117 times already, but they have one more chance to save the world. So he recruits a group of patrons from the diner and tells them that they have this one night to save the world from an AI apocalypse. They need to stop a small child from programming an AI that will essentially destroy life as we know it. So he manages to enlist some people and they set off traveling, let's be honest, a couple of blocks to do this one thing. As part of that, we get little flashback episodes which fill in who these people he's recruited are. Mm. So you have Juno Temple, you've got Zazie Beetz and Michael Peña as kind of a pair of teachers in it as well. Hayley Lou Richardson's in it, Asim Chowdhury's in it. So what this essentially is, it's a really hard thing to explain, to be honest with you. I read it as a kind of surrealist satire. It's partly about modern culture. There's a whole thing on it about school shootings. There's a lot on it, as you might imagine, about AI and technology and our reliance on it and teenagers on their phones. There's a whole Romero vignette, which feels like teenagers on phones are zombies. You know, it's not exactly pushing the boat out that far. But these little backstories feel like almost capsule Black Mirror episodes that have been bolted onto this larger satire. So it's a really weirdly uneven structure. And then it's almost as if they give up on that idea halfway through because they get through a number of them and then just don't bother with the other ones. So you're like, okay, fine. I mean, it's quite long. It's like 2 hours and 20 minutes, 2 hours and 15 minutes. So it feels bloated already. So I wasn't all that sorry that it did it. I couldn't quite work out, A, what this film was for or B, what it was doing. Because like, as a surrealist satire, it's not Boots Riley, right? Like it doesn't lean into that in a completely kooky way. So it's almost like a diet. So sort of surrealist satire. It's a little bit weird. It's a little bit satirical, but it's also a little bit first base. Mm. I also found it quite punishingly boring because it is long.
Wow.
And because it goes on these little tangents. And some of those little backstory Black Mirror episodes are actually quite good. The school shooting one is really kind of challenging and upsetting, partly in the way, in the kind of... what's the word I'm looking for? Partly in the...
normalization, kind of?
Yes. Partly in the kind of mood and the normalization of it all. Like, that's quite chilling, actually. And I think that one lands quite well. But some of the others, I don't think really landed. The one about kids being zombies on their phones, I was like, yeah, okay, whatever.
It's a bit okay, boomer.
It really is, yeah. And I think, you know, it wears a lot of its influences on its sleeves and what it's drawing from. But at the end, I just felt a little bit underserved by it and a little bit disappointed. I was really excited that Gore Verbinski was back, and this unfortunately didn't live up to the expectation.
Yeah, I give it a 3 because I was entertained for most of the running time, but I did see all of these, like you say, all of these sort of plot points coming, and I kind of wished I hadn't. And I think, you know, you have a thing here about like human cloning, which is very futuristic and very sort of sci-fi. And then you also have, oh, the teenagers are on TikTok too much, which is very like 2 years ago coded, you know, and it's like, pick one. Like it doesn't, it didn't feel coherent really in that world building. And I just wanted more of Sam Rockwell is a madman from the future who may or may not be from the future and may or may not be out to save the world or might be just completely demented. And I kind of felt like that was a much more interesting story. And every time you cut to one of these vignettes, you kind of lost the impetus of that story. This is written by Matthew Robinson, who did things like Love and Monsters, which is really charming, or Dora and the Lost City of Gold, which was like 10 times better than it had to be. So he can do a sort of sharp, funny little adventure caper. And I think this one, it was originally developed for TV, and it feels like it's still got all these ideas mashed together without really hanging coherently. It's not that I hated any of the ideas. I just didn't think that they worked all as one in a film.
No.
It should have been a 90-minute in and out rollicking caper, and I think it would have been...
It's nearly 2 hours, right? It's 2 hours.
It's 2 hours 15. And it feels it, yeah. Like there's just too many different ideas, too many competing ideas, all jostling for position in here, and it just ends up being confused. You think if they'd stripped out a lot of it and maybe brought their expectations down and just had a more sort of like laser-focused endgame, I think it would have been a better film.
Yeah. So I gave it 3 stars.
That's fair.
Three
I think it's
stars.
Fair.
For good luck, have fun, don't die. John.
Hello.
If I had legs, I'd kick you.
Harsh.
You do have legs, Chris.
Kick him.
Oh, no.
I can't. He's too far away, but I was going to lunge from him earlier on. But as it is, what I wanted to do is talk about If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You, which is, of course, the long-awaited debut on the big screen of Conan O'Brien.
Wow.
Well, true story.
He's been in a couple of things. He was in The Treasure of Foggy Mountain, Please Don't Destroy movie, which I'm sure we all remember.
All right.
But yeah, this is unusually Conan O'Brien. It's not his film, let's be clear. He is a supporting role in this, but he's very, very good.
Yes.
And very, very un-Conan O'Brien. He plays a therapist in a very understated way, and it's not a showy performance at all. It's like, you know, he's sort of quite sad and a bit miserable, and he's sort of brilliant. Mm. But anyway, we should not talk about him.
Yes, we're accidentally focusing too much on Conan O'Brien.
It was just a joke.
This is Rose Byrne's film.
This is a film, yes. Rose Byrne is the lead of this film. She plays a character called Linda, who's a therapist who is effectively a single mother. Her husband is out on, he seems to be some sort of naval captain and is basically on, you know, a long mission away at sea or something. So she's looking after her young daughter who has some sort of unspecified health issue, which
it's like
means,
a feeding disorder.
Yeah, she has to have like a drip or
she's fed sort of straight into her stomach. Yeah, because she won't eat.
And so she's trying to navigate her very chaotic life, looking after her daughter, doing her job as a therapist.
Ironically,
somewhat not often the best advice being given, I would say, as a therapist, and also like trying to speak to her own therapist, who is played by Conan O'Brien, and. This is a film by directed by Mary Bronstein, who is married to Ronald Bronstein, who is one of the co-writers for a lot of Safdie Brothers films. Josh Safdie is also a producer here. And I think that is a very instructive way into this film. I've seen this film described as uncut gems for mums. It is essentially that level of like chaos and stress and just sort of nervous, frenetic energy. It just sort of builds and builds and builds. Rose Byrne's character makes terrible decisions. Mm-hmm. She is just a chaos energy personified. And it's sort of oddly funny. It's like stressful to watch her like make all these really, really poor choices. But she's fantastic in it. She's utterly compelling. I think she got an Oscar nomination for this.
She did, yeah.
Maybe
right.
The only Oscar nomination this film got, which is a bit of a shame. But it is like, it's one of those performances where you are just sort of simultaneously want to look away and you can't stop looking. It's magnetic.
I think Bronstein shot it is incredible because her daughter, which is a crucial part of this story, you almost never see her. She's always off camera. It's always just tight on Rose Byrne's face as she just becomes increasingly unraveled. It is so relentlessly stressful and she's massively unlikable as well. So honestly, the film is an ordeal. It is. Yeah. And it's 2 hours long as well. It's incredible, but it's exhausting and it's annoying and it's upsetting and it's infuriating. And the most sympathetic character is her sort of drug dealer neighbor played by A$AP Rocky, who's a lot of fun.
Yes. But
Conan O'Brien plays this weird therapist who has a slightly odd relationship with her as well. And they kind of work opposite each other in the same hallway. And then one of her patients comes in and abandons a child. And
Danielle McDonald.
Right. And so many different things happen. And it's almost like you think this couldn't get any more stressful. And then another plate is added to her stack. So by the end, you're just like, I need to have a lie down. So I'm not sure I enjoyed this film. I'm not sure anyone will enjoy this film, but I am sure it's good.
I think some people will find it cathartic and almost cleansing to see this level of honesty about the shit show that is parenthood, not just motherhood, but certainly motherhood in this case.
Well, certainly single parenting, without
absolutely.
Support or help.
And you know, we didn't even mention, like, there's been problems with her flat, so she's trying to sort all of that out. You know, she's in a slightly one-sided war with a parking attendant. Like, an interesting thing is I talked to both Bronstein and Byrne for this, and Bronstein said, basically, she makes the only possible right choice every moment for her. Like, yes, of course, it would be better if she, like, lit a scented candle and took a bath instead of maybe, I don't know, getting out of her mind with A$AP Rocky each night. She is also insomnia, by the way. But that is, she is not capable of making that decision. She is making the only possible decision that she can make in these circumstances at every turn. And yes, they are terrible decisions, but that's kind of the way it is. I think the gimmick, I guess, or gimmick is a harsh word, but the choice to not have the child who's played by Delaney Quinn on screen. She was present when they were shooting. She was always there. It wasn't like a child labor thing. She was always there. So Rose Byrne had somebody to react to. But it's not about her and it's not about blaming the child for what this woman is suffering. It is about the relentlessness of caring for a sick child and the relentlessness of being a parent and a mother in particular. And I think that is a really, really smart decision because it absolutely puts you there with Rose Byrne's Linda at every single moment. I think it's an astonishing film. Yeah, it's not easy, but it's really, really effective.
Yeah.
Bronstein, seriously, is a massive talent. I mean, this is for her second feature, I think. And this is a big step up, I think, from her first.
All right. We give this one 4 stars. And 4 stars for If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You. Rose Byrne, going to win the Oscar?
Probably not. But honestly, I think she maybe should.
Oh,
she's very good.
You know I love Hamnet and you know I love Jesse Buckley, but I think this is a degree of toughness beyond that.
If anyone's going to take out Buckley, it's Byrne, right?
Sick Byrne.
I would watch that cop show, Byrne and Buckley. Can
Buckley
you imagine?
And Byrne.
Fucking, that'd be amazing.
I don't know. I'm torn between rooting for the Irish woman and Moira McTaggart. It's too tough. It's too tough. Anyway, 4 stars in for If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You. We're going to be joined on next week's podcast by Rose Byrne, which is very, very exciting. John, we're going to stick with you now to talk about Waste Man. Waste Man.
Waste Man, yes. This is a very different film. This is a British independent film, a debut from writer-director Cal McMow. And this is a prison movie. And you know, there are many prison movies and you sort of get a sense of what a prison movie is. And to some extent, this does follow that formula. You know, it's a sort of gritty tale from the inside. It's very tough, turns out, being a prisoner. But what I really appreciated about this is how gritty it is. It feels like it's in a sort of social realist tradition in some ways. It's a little bit like a sort of modern Scum in some ways. But it's also like, it feels like it's speaking to what is happening in prisons, and specifically British prisons right now. So David Johnson plays a prisoner called Taylor, who's been in prison for over a decade. And then an opportunity arises for him to get parole because of an early release program that the government is introducing because of overcrowding in prisons, which is actually a real thing. The government have been trying to release prisoners who have good behavior because they need to get rid of, they need to find space, basically. So he just needs to have some good behavior and he'll be out of prison in a few weeks. But then along shows a new cellmate played by Tom Blythe from Hunger Games, mm-hmm. called Dee, who is a slightly more dangerous presence. He's chaotic, violent, and he runs a tuck shop. I'm not sure that's what they would be called in a prison, but a shop out of his cell. And suddenly the danger sort of increases for Taylor, and maybe his chance of getting out of prison is lessened. What is so interesting about the way this story is told is like it plays into what prisoners are doing these days, which is videoing on mobile phones their experiences. There's a lot of shots which are just like the vertical frame, you know, the portrait mode that you get with phones. And a lot of it feels like kind of verite. It feels like real. There are a few shots that are like, is this a real shot? It's really well done. And I really appreciated the performances as well. David Johnson, I mean, we know now is, you know, one of our best new actors. And I love how versatile he's been in every film I've seen him. And this is so different from Ry Lane or Alien Romulus. He's so understated and sad and a bit desperate and clearly broken by the institution. And Tom Blythe is astonishing as well. Very, very sinister and threatening and just this sort of looming presence. I really love this. I thought this was really interesting. It's really well shot. It shows really like a lot of promise from Cal McMahon. It is essentially a prison movie. It isn't totally breaking the mold, but I was very impressed by this. So we gave this one 4 stars.
4 stars, fantastic. 4 stars then for Waste Man, and David Johnson and Tom Blythe will be on this week's edition of The Interviews, along with Asim Chowdhury, who is in Good Luck, Have Fun, Don't Die. And on that note, that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun, where we'll be joined by... Well, there's Rose Byrne, there's Neve Campbell, there's Amanda Seyfried, and Mona Fassfold, star and director of The Testament of Anne Lee. Neve Campbell, of course, star of Scream 7. One of those will be the main guest, the others will be in the interviews. It's all very, very exciting. But until then, until we meet again, until that auspicious occasion, it is goodbye from my three colleagues of such lethal cunning. Goodbye, John Nugent.
Goodbye.
Goodbye to you. Goodbye, Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo.
Goodbye, Tin Jim.
It's Dr. Doom to you.
Dr. Tin Jim.
No, absolutely not.
That may be my favourite of all the nicknames so far.
No.
Tin Jim. And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to go to Palpatine's Pancakes for a lovely, lovely slice of a buttercream pancake. What the fuck is that?
It doesn't make any sense.
You want this, don't you? Take it. Strike me down. Take your father's plate of pancakes by my side.
You probably could make pancakes with buttercream, like as an ingredient.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm fucking saying.
You wouldn't.
No.
Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.